Welcome to Cover to Cover. This is Richard A. Lupoff.
And I'm Richard Walensky, and our guest is Frank M. Robinson, who has a new book, Science Fiction of the 20th Century and Illustrated History, also Waiting, a novel. Earlier novels include The Power and co-author of The Glass Inferno, several other books. Also co-author of Pulp Culture, The Art of Fiction magazines, which in many ways is related to the illustrated history of science fiction, which is your newest work. I guess the place to start is with this illustrated history. It's partly a history, but more than that, it's a showcase for the covers of the old pulp magazines and also the posters for films and the covers of books. What was your intention here?
Well, the intention is right in the title. The intention is to present an illustrated history of the magazines and the books and films. And we went from actually the late 1890s up to something as recent as The Phantom Menace.
You have a remarkable collection of pulps. Did all of this material come from your own home, from your own collection?
Most of the magazine covers did, but not all. I ended up borrowing different magazines, books, paperbacks, dust jackets, posters from different collectors all over the country. It represents not only me, but a dozen other hardcore collectors.
These books, these two art books of yours, Pulp Culture and Science Fiction of the 20th Century, it seems to me involve some new technology that is fascinating, something that art books over the decades have never used, and that is the use of the scanner and computer processing of the images. Talk about that, how that came about and how it works.
Especially on Pulp Culture, we were going to go with Canon Xerox copies, which are really quite good. But the publisher insisted on using original material, which meant, in this case, either photographs or digital scanning. And digital scanning means like your local, your homegrown HP scanner. The Pulp Culture is pretty much of a learning exercise on using a scanner for reproducing cover images and all of that, putting the actual magazine on the scanner. It was a learning process because in so doing, we picked up a lot of what they call moiré patterns. When it came time to do the science fiction book, we actually scanned all the images twice. We used one rough scan for positioning and then a scan to size for the final scan.
Somewhere along the line, did you become adept at Photoshop? Because I know that that generally when you do scan in, you have to do some kind of tweaking.
I didn't do the scans.
Oh, okay.
A pulp collector and computer nerd in Baltimore, John Gunnison, did the actual scans. For Pulp Culture, that consisted of sending him all of the material. For the science fiction book, I imported John. I paid his airfare. It was cheaper than FedExing all the magazines.
So you wouldn't remember what the DPI was on it?
I believe the DPI was around 300.
That's all?
Yeah.
Okay, I may edit this out, I think. But anyway, you want to pick it up?
Well, yes. I wanted to ask about pulp covers, magazine covers, book covers, and other such mass media art images and how they relate to what we think of gallery art, museum art, or fine art.
You're talking about the magazine cover art?
Well, most specifically, yes. Let's talk about Pulp magazine covers. First of all, for those in our listenership who are not familiar with the Pulp magazines, give us a description of an archetypal one.
Well, the archetype typical pulp would have been a 7x10 magazine printed on a rough quality newsprint with a four-color letterpress cover. The you're talking about magazine illustrative art as compared to fine art, correct?
Exactly.
Illustrative art in a magazine, when you look at a magazine cover, you're looking at a gestalt. It's not just alone the painting. It's the painting plus the logo plus the cover titles. And this is the impression that you get. If you strip the logo off the artwork, if you took away all the cover titles, you would end up with minimalist art. The original painting, which would be so impressive when it was on the cover, would be nothing when looked at just as the artwork. In very few exceptions, there has been illustrative art and fine art all the time. A lot of Alma Tadema in England, a realist that was illustrative art. Remington was illustrative art. There's been a great deal of illustrative art, meaning art that tells a story. And that's probably the difference between magazine cover art and fine art.
And I suppose that concept of magazine cover art carries over to mass market paperback books, or does it?
Sure. If you took a I have some covers from mass market paperbacks at the house. All of the action, all of the everything you look at in the art is concentrated in the bottom two thirds. The top one third, which is where the title comes, is almost a blank. Nothing is happening in that area. A drastic difference between that kind of art and fine art, again, where fine art uses the entire canvas to carry whatever the art is. Illustrative art does not.
Science fiction of the 20th century and illustrated history is more than just pictures from the magazines. It's also the story of science fiction. And very much the story of science fiction is the story of the pulp magazines. Dick and I have been doing this show since the late 70s, and those who remember this show when it was called Probabilities know that we discuss the pulps a lot. But there are a lot of newcomers out there who don't know what they were. I'd like you to put that in context, put the science fiction pulp magazines in context of the story of magazines in America and fiction writing in America. There were books prior to the turn of the century, and there were magazines. What were their relationships, and how did the confluence of books and magazines work in terms of the early days of science fiction?
You're asking 2 hours worth of answers in one question.
I know, but
however,
this is the era of sound bites. Go for it.
Going ahead. In the first place, there are you're talking about two fields. The original field for science fiction, which is a youth-oriented, or was very important, was a youth-oriented genre, was dime novels, primarily dime novels in this country. Adult science fiction appeared in the Strand magazine. It appeared in the United States Cosmopolitan, primarily in the stories of H.G. Wells. Pulp magazines, which started in 1896, the first was Argosy. they published science fiction right from the get-go. The very first issue of Argosy had a science fiction story in it. As time went on, science fiction stories began to crop up in the Science and Mechanics magazines, especially in the magazines edited by Hugo Gernsback. He ran a couple of science fiction stories in almost every issue of Science and Invention. In 1924, he published a science fiction issue, or a scientifiction issue, of Science and Invention, which sold very well. 2 years later, he began a magazine devoted to nothing but amazing stories, which came out in April of 1926. He published an annual, he published a quarterly. Later in 1929, when he lost control of Amazing, he reappeared on the newsstand with Science Wonder, Air Wonder, Science Wonder Quarterly. The first five science fiction magazines were all by Hugo Gernsback. It took until 1930 for the regular pulp publishers to figure out that, hey, this is a viable field. The first one to do that was Clayton, which came out with Astounding Stories of Super Science, ran it until 1933. The magazine went into bankruptcy. The title was sold. Astounding was sold to Street & Smith.
Wait a second. I'm going to interrupt you here. Dick Lupoi found out some interesting information about that earlier today, which was...
In fact, Frank and I have the same source. Apparently, the Clayton titles all went up for auction. One of them, for instance, Ranch Romances, went for $30,000. Astounding Stories of Super Science went for, fill in the blank, buddy,
$100. Count them.
If you had a time machine, you could be the publisher of Astounding Stories for $100.
Okay, now we're up to 1930. Suddenly, these other publishers have said, there's money in them thar hills, and began publishing science fiction magazines. Meanwhile, what happened to science fiction books after Verne, after Wells, after the dime novels? Were there books being published between, say, 1900 and 1930?
You had H. Rider Haggard, and you even had Ray Cummings, who came out with a book or two, but the superstar was Edgar Rice Burroughs, and he dominated the field from about 1912 came out in 1912 in Magazine. He dominated the book field for almost that entire period, with Pellucidar, his Mars series, Tarzan, all of those, something like 59 novels in all, 24 of them Tarzan. From, I would say, the first book publication of Tarzan was probably around 1914-15. From then until the late 20s.
And then by 1930, these other publishers woke up, and suddenly you had an influx of new writers, and it wasn't just Edgar Rice Burroughs, and it wasn't just Ray Cummings. It was a lot of other people.
You had Olaf Stapleton over in England. I wouldn't say a lot, but you had a number of them here in the States. Dick could probably fill you in on the various names.
What we need to do, though, is look at a file, or at least a history of these magazines, such as Science Fiction of the 20th Century. Look at those covers with those dazzling images of outer space and giant megalopolitan machinery and strange creatures, and of course the infamous space ladies wearing brass brassieres, to see what the feeling was of science fiction in that era, and just look on those covers and see the names of the great writers, some of whose works remain in print to this day, some of whom, although very, very old, are still with us and still writing. I think of the great Jack Williamson.
an interesting comment here. Back in the heydays of the pulps, the cover was extremely important, primarily because of the competition on the newsstand. You had to have a cover that would grab the reader as he went by. Reason for that is almost all the magazines, their circulation was off the newsstand. Today it's completely different. A minority of magazines are sold on the newsstand. The cover no longer has that position of importance that it once had. When you look at the current circulation of Astounding, which is half of what it used to be, or analog, I should say, it's 50,000. Only a fraction of those ever show up on the newsstand. Almost all of them are subscriptions. The cover has been downrated, and unfortunately, in most of the magazines, it shows. The cover is not well thought out. It's minimized.
Frank Robinson, want to ask two questions. First of all, to people who have never seen a pulp magazine and see one for the first time, I think you yourself have said, they take one look and say, that's a comic book. Is a comic book really just a sort of mutation on the pulp magazine?
No. I think it reached much the same audience, but comic books started not as... almost not as genre. I believe that a lot of your comics started as collections of the original comic strips that ran in the newspapers. Later on, particularly in the superhero epics, they picked up a lot of influence from the genre pulp magazines of the period. But nowadays, I think that there is a distinct comic book audience that may not buy the, say, the Digest science fiction magazines at all, any more than the people who go to see Star Wars or Star Trek will necessarily pick up a science fiction magazine.
Frank M. Robinson, it's 1930, 1933, and you're in New York. You get on the subway at that point, and you look down the line of people standing or sitting, how many of them do you think would be reading a pulp magazine?
A lot of them. Back then, a lot of them. Pulp magazines were the, well, look, back then, early 30s, no paperbacks to speak of. If you were reading fiction, hardbacks were expensive. Pulp magazines could be had for anywhere from a dime to 20 cents. 25 cents was unusual. Your audience, depending on the genre, if you were reading Blue Book or Argosy, you would tend to be older. If you were reading The Shadow or Doc Savage or Astounding or Thrilling Wonder, you would tend to be younger. So that the audience would kind of split there. Later on, the older people on your BMT or subway, they'd be reading the Saturday Evening Post, Collier's, maybe Liberty. But the young shop girls would be reading Love Story.
A few minutes ago, we had an interesting exchange where the title for Astounding Stories was sold for $100. The title for Ranch Romances for $30,000.
I believe it was $10,000, wasn't it? Well, okay. Anyway, a vast sum, more.
In looking at that, how come we still know about Astounding? We don't know anything about Ranch Romances. I mean, that must have been pretty popular in those days.
Ranch Romances was the last of the pulps. It lasted until sometime in the 60s, I think it had a regional distribution in the West. But why did Astounding achieve prominence and Ranch Romances fade?
Oh, I think that came later because of John W. Campbell, who was the editor of Astounding.
No, it came later for a number of reasons that most genre people don't think of. Ranch romance has died with the mythology of the West. By the 40s, by the early 50s, the mythology of the West had moved pretty much to television. Radio before that. But it was not just ranch romances that died. Ranch romances just lasted longer. But Western Story died, Wild West Weekly died, the West died.
You're listening to an interview with Frank M. Robinson, author of Science Fiction of the 20th Century and Illustrated History, also a novel, Waiting. Dick Lupoff.
I want to ask you a couple of questions about numbers. Let me ask you three numbers. First of all, how many kinds of pulps were there? We know there were science fiction, there were westerns, there were murder mysteries, but how many kinds were there? Secondly, what was the circulation of one of these magazines? Would they struggle along with 3,000 readers, or did they have 300,000? Thirdly, how many pulp magazines were there?
First of all, the number of titles, 400 to 500, 40 to 50,000 issues, all told. Highest circulation, toss-up between Argosy in the period around 1907 to 1915, and Street and Smith's Love Story, both weeklies, both at their peak, selling between 600,000 to 700,000 copies, most of them off the newsstands.
And that was in a country with a population of, what, 100 million? About a third of what it is now?
About 130 million around 1930. Mm-hmm. I should have to point out that, say, Time magazine does maybe 150,000 off the stands out of a total circulation of 4 million or so. The largest newsstand circulation in modern times, outside of the perennials like TV Guide, Reader's Digest, largest newsstand circulation was probably Playboy, about the time when I was working for it, by the way.
And what were their numbers?
In the early 1970s, close to 7 million. I would say 5 to 6 of it off the stands.
And what is it today?
Playboy today is about 3.25, 3.5. A large part of it now is subscription.
Still very, very impressive numbers.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Let me ask you a question about the literary quality of the pulps. Is that all just a bunch of trash that came and went as fast as the paper disintegrated, or was there material of merit?
It's a popular misconception. In the first place, when the pulp started, many of the same writers wrote for the pulps that wrote for the slick magazines of the period. You would find Agatha Christie all over the place, but primarily in Blue Book. You would find Mary Roberts Rinehart in All Story. The authors were largely interchangeable. Back then, if you failed to hit the post, you would submit your manuscript to, say, Argosy.
Well, what was the difference between, and incidentally, we've had guests on this very show who, let's say, even in the 1940s, were selling both to the slick magazines, Collier's, Saturday Evening Post, and so forth. What was the difference? If you were an author of that caliber and turned out a short story, and you're sitting there saying, should I send it to Saturday Evening Post? Should I send it to Blue Book? What difference would it make?
Not that much difference, depending on intent of the author, not that much difference in the quality of the writing. Financially, if you sold a story to the Post, you could expect $1,000 to $3,000, possibly more. Who's the fellow who wrote The Great Gatsby?
Fitzgerald.
Fitzgerald. I think he got $4,000 to $5,000 a story. Hemingway sold The Old Man and the Sea to Life magazine for $30,000.
Mm-hmm.
But the average going rate in the pulps pardon me, the Slicks, To the Post, The Colliers, would have been $1,000 to $2,000 or $3,000. If you're selling to Argosy, Blue Book, Adventure, Astounding, Galaxy, you're talking 2 to 3 cents a word.
Which, on a short story of equivalent length, let's say 3,000 words, would be what?
For a Slick magazine, for a pulp, you're talking about $30. For a Slick, you're talking $3,000. it kind of evened out. If you wanted to make money in the pulps, you were a production man. You were an early Earl Stanley Gardner or Max Brand who could make $50,000 a year during the Depression years writing for the pulps. But they had to turn out an enormous amount of wordage to do that. Myself, I once did a novella of around 12,000-20,000 words, which I had intended for Astounding, which would have paid me $600. My agent sold it to Playboy for $3,000. So that was a factor of five. But back in the heyday of the pulps, the factor would have been far closer to 10 or 20.
There were also writers, and I'm thinking of one in particular who probably no one has ever heard of today, named Ethel Repp, who would write the same story over and over and set it as a Western, or set it as a detective story, or set it as science fiction, and just keep selling these things over and over right across the lines. How many of those kind of writers were there? People we would not hear of today who just, they just filled the pulps with stuff.
Well, you're looking at a field of 300 to 400 titles coming out in the average of, say, 100 different titles a month. That's a lot of wordage. All the editors out there knew good from bad. They knew the difference between Ed Earl Repp and Ray Bradbury. They knew the difference between Dashiell Hammett, Raymond Chandler, and practically everybody else. They could tell the difference between C.S. Forster and all the other C-story writers. But you had to fill the magazine, and there were a lot of them. So that, sure, you could run a star, maybe twice in the same magazine. Then you had to pick up the reps and whatnot to fill out your 60,000 words.
But that also made the editors extremely important to the whole field. I mean, far more important, perhaps, than editors are today. Or did it?
Yeah. Editors were very important because editors could develop writers. Cap Shaw, for Black Mask, could develop writers. Granted that his previous editors discovered Hammett, but he was the guy who developed Hammett. He developed Chandler. It was Donald Kennicott, primarily on Blue Book, who picked up Agatha Christie, who would pick up names of the period and develop them, work with them. In the science fiction field, you had a number of editors, the most prominent one of which was probably John Campbell, who worked to develop Robert Heinlein and Isaac Asimov and E.E. Van Vogt and other writers of the period. Horace Gold did a lot to develop writers for Galaxy.
If we look at the culture of today and we see, say, an art form that has some good stuff, a lot of garbage, where the executives are more important than the creators, but where stars are born, where they arise, that's dealt with the mass market. It sounds to me like, in a weird way, the pulps of the 30s and 40s were the equivalent, not so much of the paperback books today, but of television.
Hard to say. The amount of product that we talk about, the amount of product that television consumes, can't hold a candle to the amount of product that the pulp magazines consumed in their heyday. You have to have a minimum level of expertise to do script for either film or television. You might ask, why are there so many terrible television shows, so many terrible movies? We have to take for granted that very, very few people deliberately put out crap. Same way in the magazines. Very few of them deliberately put out crap. They had no other choice. If you talk to a lot of the magazine editors today, oddly enough, though there are far fewer magazines, they'll tell you the same thing, that the amount of people submitting, say, to Science Fiction Age or some of the other magazines, they get in hundreds of manuscripts a month. Most of them are crap.
Frank M. Robinson, let's move to some of your other work. You have a novel that will be coming out very soon, or is out in trade paper, called Waiting. This, when you were writing it, you said to me it's kind of a sequel to an earlier novel called The Power, but kind of not a sequel. What is the relationship of your earlier book, The Power, to your newer novel, Waiting?
Well, Waiting was originally intended as a direct sequel to The Power. And then in looking over the original book, there were so many unanswered questions. It was so loose in a scientific sense that I started to codify a little bit more. And it still is, in both cases, you're investigating a species other than our own. That much is the same in both books. In The Power, the hero, the villain, whatever you want to call him, is a Superman. I'm dealing with one individual of superhuman powers. If you want to see the genesis for it, go back to an old story, an unknown called But Without Horns, where you're dealing essentially with one man who is a Superman among all the mundanes, which is a word I despise, but among all the average people. In Waiting, it's codified a lot more. You're dealing with another species. What is interesting here is today we tend to look at all our friends and neighbors who are all members of Homo sapiens. We are the penultimate species in human history. We're the only branch of hominids roaming around. That's a fluke. Never used to be that way. That's very unusual. Throughout all of the history of hominids, ape men, and all of that, there's always been two or three species coexisting at the same time. And that's what I worked with. My original idea was, hey, what if Neanderthals were still running around today? And then I figured, that won't do. Neanderthals are safely extinct. There has to be another species, one of which we have no record. And why do we not have a record explained in the book? When the book, when the manuscript was finished, I was astonished to read a story in the New York Times where three species, three, had coexisted at the same time. Neanderthals, Homo sapiens, Homo erectus, etc. And the point being, if there is another species, how would the dominant species, Homo sapiens, treat them? And you don't have to look around you very far. How do we treat other races? How did we treat other tribes? How do we treat, my God, people of different religions, different colors, what have you? What do you think we would do with another species around? And Ian Tattersall, who's the director of anthropology at the National Museum, not the Museum of Natural History in New York, was one of the very first anthropologists to suggest that Homo sapiens practiced genocide, that particularly in the Neanderthals who lived up in northern Europe, the reindeer migrated through northern Europe, and the out of Africa Homo sapiens followed the track of the reindeer, and you suddenly had Neanderthals and Homo sapiens competing for the same food source, what do you think they did? Well, Tattersall suggests genocide, and so do I in the book. The question is, which I investigated full length, if you have another species, to what length would they go to remain hidden, to keep us from knowing about them?
I'd like to ask you a little bit more about the background of this book from the viewpoint of zoology. Let me tell you what I'm getting at. For instance, you say there used to be several species of humans. Now, if we look around, there are several species of cats. An ordinary domestic short hair and a Siamese are different breeds or subspecies, but they're the same species. But a domestic cat and a lion are different species, even though they're both cats. Now, let's say an African pygmy and a tall blonde Norwegian are both humans. They're both Homo sapiens. They're the same species. What would, technically speaking, what would make a different species of humans, but yet who is still a human, not a chimpanzee? It's a true human being, but it's not us.
Without going into the science of cladistics, which is the science of measurement of bone and all of that, the ratio of this bone to that bone, etc., the hallmark of a species is whether or not it can produce viable offspring, meaning offspring that can reproduce their own kind. Theoretically, could the pygmy and the blonde Norwegian produce offspring who in turn could produce offspring? The answer is yes. You are dealing with the same species. Could Neanderthal and Homo sapiens have interbred? It all depends on what school you go to. There are those who maintain that Neanderthals were a completely different species. Could Neanderthal and Homo sapiens have interbred and produced offspring? Chances are very good that they could have, but the offspring could not have reproduced.
They would have been mules.
They would have been mules. For the same thing that, donkeys and horses can interbreed, and they produce mules. Very interesting there, because they have discovered bones that it would look like the original owner of the bones combined characteristics of both Homo sapiens and Neanderthal. But you might be dealing with, in this case, you might be dealing with the bones of a mule. You don't know. Nobody knows.
Or of the hypothetical third species.
No. No, they would not produce if they could interbreed and produce viable offspring that could reproduce, then Neanderthal and Homo sapiens are the same species, which is one of the big arguments in anthropology today. Are they the same, or were they separate species? Did Homo sapiens merely subsume all of the genes of Neanderthal so that the characteristics of Neanderthal were lost in a larger gene pool? You don't know. That's a theory.
Frank M. Robinson, Wading came out last year. You have this new book, Science Fiction of the 20th Century and Illustrated History. Are you working on another novel, or are you working on another illustrated book?
I have. Thank you for asking that. Look, I did two illustrated books in a row. I think they were very good books. They were enormously time-consuming, not all that profitable to me, at least not yet. And I'm afraid I've reached burnout on illustrated books. I'm very happy and very pleased with what I did with the science fiction book and with what Lawrence Davidson and I did with the pulp book. But I don't think I'm about to go back. The life is a tad too short. Lately, I've been doing screenplays, I've done one for Paramount based on an idea by Francis Coppola, and I've also done a screenplay on The Dark Beyond the Stars, which was a science fiction novel of about 8 years back, a hardcore science fiction novel, rocket ships and all of that.
You've been listening to an interview with Frank M. Robinson, whose latest book is Science Fiction of the 20th Century and Illustrated History. I'm Richard Walensky with Richard A. Lupoff on Cover to Cover.